Welcome to Behind the DM Screen for January of 2024. We are three DMs helping each other out. I'm Jeff Greiner. With me, as always, as often is Sam Dillon.
Hello.
And subbing in for Mike today is the wonderful Robert Aducci.
Hello.
And that's your introduction. So I guess we get started. I need my phone so I can start a timer. We're going to spend
the all-important timer.
The all-important timer that we stick to very, very strictly. I'm going to put 15 minutes on the clock. And first on the speaking order today is Robert. Our guest gets to be the first one to talk about his game and tell us how things are going. So
I think I was first last time, too.
You might have been, because I think it was three episodes. Recordings.
Oh, there you go.
Have been first, yep.
Nice. All right.
Take it away.
So I've got two campaigns that are in a big place right now. One of them, they just sort of semi-resurrected the god of portals, Eoskar. And so it was my Planescape game, and then it went kind of to Forgotten Realms, and now we're back to Planescape. And so the god has like a form, and then was telling the party that, well, now they need a body, and so they have to go find the body in the astral sea and do something to allow the god to go in it or whatever. And so,
do you know as the DM where that body is or
no?
Okay,
no. So the only thing I know so far is basically like they went just last session. They went met some, you know, astral traveler, told them to go to this sort of astral bar, essentially. And they met some Gidzeri there. And I said that some Gidzeri were in a monastery and they knew something. So they're going to go there. Mm-hmm. They're going to tell them that what they need to find it is in this, in a fortress held by a bunch of, oh gosh, what are they called? The monodrones and duodrones, mm-hmm. the modron. Mm-hmm. And so there are a bunch of rogue modrons that have this fortress floating in the astral sea. So they're going to have to get this spyglass that will let them see far away to find this thing.
Okay.
Now, where it is, I have no idea. So any ideas you got on that, let me know.
I have a suggestion about what's going on there more than I do about where it is. I mean, the astral mm-hmm. sea, it's the astral sea. So it's
right.
It's as far away or as close as you want it to be, really.
Exactly.
Although it is a fun opportunity since fifth edition moved Spelljammer to the astral sea, it gives you a fun opportunity to have them get on a spelljamming ship and do some spelljamming. You know, it's your Planescape Forgotten Realms spelljamming campaign all of a sudden. Right.
I'm totally down for that.
But the Githzerai, they set up, they live on bodies of gods in the astral sea, as I recall.
I think it was the Githyanki.
Or the Githyanki do. Okay, even better. Because mm-hmm. I was going to say, mm-hmm. it's clearly, I mean, the obvious answer is it's got to be populated by Githyanki.
Mm-hmm.
And that perhaps the Githzerai had an ulterior motive in helping them because they would like to learn where this hidden base of Githyanki is as well. And they're mm-hmm, using mm-hmm. the PCs as sort of the pawns to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. I like that idea.
And I mean, normally, like, if that is because that is sort of the obvious standard trope of D&D god bodies floating around mm-hmm, with mm-hmm. Yankee living on them, right? But if you haven't done it before in your campaign,
right? I've never done it.
It's not cliche, and none of them have mm-hmm. experienced that. So I always go to the cliche first.
Sure.
And then once I've done it, okay, now I got to mix it up. But
right.
I mean, in my mind, that's the obvious go-to. And if I'm bringing in Githzerai and Githyanki, there's definitely going to be some mind flayers in there somewhere. Maybe when they get mm-hmm, to the mm-hmm. body, like the Githyanki are already being assaulted by mind. I don't know. I like mind flayers, and this gives an opportunity to play with both. I like the Gith. This gives an opportunity to play with both of those things.
Yeah, totally. I think those are great ideas. The other kind of thing I was still holding on to until sort of the last minute was to try to figure out like what they actually have to do to allow the body to be like able to accept the divinity of the god. That I have like no idea about. Like, I don't know, like they're not very magically oriented. There's no wizards or high level clerics.
Okay.
So, you know, some rituals, probably not the best idea. So yeah, that one I'm kind of stuck on. I mean, my fallback was going to be like, find some astral diamonds, because they used an astral diamond to free her from where she was trapped essentially before. And so that was going to be my fallback, like something else with astral diamonds. But
well, I have the beginning of some ideas, but I don't want to dominate. I'm going to let Sam share his musings.
I mean, I think you should share your ideas.
Okay, okay. I just don't want to be stepping on your toes.
No, you're good.
I think the obvious first step is you have to get the parasites out of the body.
Right.
Somehow you got to get the Enki off. Does that mean you're going to walk in and slaughter the entire encampment or civilization of Githyanki? Or is it going to be some way of convincing them to leave? Or maybe they manipulate the mind flayers into scaring them off for you or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. It depends on how overwhelming of a presence of Gith you want to have there. If it's an encampment that's small enough that they could come in and have a tough fight, or a small little like dungeon or whatever to clear it out, mm-hmm. then that's one thing. But it could also be interesting to have it's a really large, overwhelming force. There's no way you can fight your way through mm-hmm. this entire city of Gith. You need to come up with a plan B, at which point it mm-hmm. becomes, can we convince them that staying here isn't worthwhile because we are introducing some other threat like the Mind Flayers or something else?
Convince the Mind Flayers to deal with them.
Convince the Mind Flayers to, oh, hey, look, we found this encampment of Gith you've been hunting for. You go take care of them, and then the Gith will chase them off or whatever, right?
Right.
At that point, I think it's an issue of, at least in my head, it would be, okay, now let's make sure the body is whole. Like there has been for theoretically what, thousands of years, of this body floating around in the astral sea. There mm-hmm. has been there have recently been Gith living on it, but who knows what's been living on it before. Parts of the body might be missing. And so now you suddenly have this MacGuffin side quest of, oh, we have to go and recover the heart of Eoskar that was excavated mm-hmm. years ago. It has been carried away. And now it is the central piece of the spelljammer on a Neo-Gi ship or, you know, some whatever, right? But that way it gives you an opportunity to explore other areas and do other things, you know, find the heart, find the eyes, find the whatever it is, whatever body parts you want to have them hunt down. And then once the body is whole, since they don't have a spellcaster, you're not going to do a ritual, you know, because I did a similar thing in my fourth edition campaign where they were bringing a dead god back to life. I think they were bringing Azuth back to life from the Forgotten Realms. And it was like, there's a big ritual going on and now you have to defend yourselves while the ritual concludes itself and all these people who don't want to see this happen show up and try to stop you. But you're not going to do the big ritual thing because that's not your group, right? So it could just be an issue of like, find all the various parts. And it could be one part, it could be a dozen parts. It depends on how long you want to drag that out, right? Mm-hmm. And where you want to have them explore. You know, this could be an opportunity to be like, hey, we're going to go to every published world that's ever been out because we got to pop in and find the left toenail of Eoskar or whatever, you know, and some half giant on Athas is using it as a shield or, you know, whatever, you know, so
gave them an opportunity to go to Athas and they were like, no.
Okay. but point being, you could really drag it out and have a million different body parts, or it could just be one. And that way you could lead them to whatever, use it as a MacGuffin to lead them to all the fun and interesting places you might want them to go and explore.
Yeah, I like that. I was also just thinking of, for some reason, when you're talking about kicking the Githyanki out or whatever, it made me think of like Space Hulk. And I was like, oh, it's going to be like a god that's a Space Hulk. And like, mm-hmm. you have to go inside of it and root out the Githyanki or whatever. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nice. Cool. Lots of great ideas. Thank you. Those are good. How much time do I have left? Because I got another campaign. 6 minutes. All right. Yeah. So my other campaign, another one is, so actually I think I talked about the tier campaign that was going to start, and it has started now. And so but they said they don't want to do like the main story that everybody does, like free tier kind of thing, mm-hmm. from Kallak. And so right now, like one of them's a bard and wants to know all about tier and under tier and things like that. And so we're kind of going that way. And so I want to like map out under tier more and see what's down there, and just come up with more cool places that would be in under tier that they can find. Okay. So like one of the places that's in one of the books is called like the Poison Sting, where it's like a bunch of bards and ne'er-do-wells hang out there. And, you know, it's kind of like a tavern for defilers and whatnot. And so, you know, kind of other places like that, and just cool, you know, I don't know, just interesting places. Like there's maybe like 7 or 8 that are detailed, and not even that detailed, like a paragraph or two. So I'd like to come up with some other cool places that they could find. And so part of Undertier was the city before, and Kallak like covered it in stone. And so that's why, you know, they can go down there and dig stuff out.
So a wretched hive of scum and defilery.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm not steeped in Athas enough to really give you like off the cuff ideas of what the,
but just is. Like ideas of just like, you know,
right.
It doesn't have to be specific. Yeah.
Right. But so what I would do in that situation, I need a bunch of interesting locations, is I'm going to open up some of the, I don't know, 12 dozen PDFs that I've bought over the last 10 years right. or whatever. And I'm gonna pull up the various books of layers from Kobold Press and see if there's some I can just tear out and stick in there. I'm gonna look at other settings and be like, hey, you know what's totally down there? That city from the end of Rime of the Frostmaiden. There's a whole big, you know, 12th level adventure they can go through in that city. I'm gonna pull out Skullport from under Waterdeep, and I'm gonna make that in part of it. Or you know, tweak
that's
it.
That's a good right? idea.
Obviously make it,
yeah,
make
yeah.
it setting appropriate. Boy, that's putting the Rime of the Frostmaiden city in there would be tricky because there's no ice.
Yeah.
You would think, but somebody actually converted and is running Rime of the Frostmaiden in Dark Sun.
Are they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's just extreme. You go from one extreme environment right. and you just convert everything to the other type of extreme, right? Instead of too much ice, now it's sand and desert. So I was thinking, don't forget to add places in there that could be good, right? So,
sure.
Like, there's probably some sort of black market mm-hmm. that is happening in tier that, and there's probably something of a gray market as well, right? And so those would have their headquarters located hidden away, so that even if they're above ground, sort of, you know, wherever they're doing their deals got raided, so to speak, and found out, they always knew how to escape and go to their headquarters down below and regroup, and then pick another location where they'll start to run their business out of topside. And then how do they get that message out to their normal clientele? Like, so there's going to be a network of sort of almost a sort of thieves guild type thing, but not for assassination, robbery, and murder, just mm-hmm. for like black market. We're just under the radar, you know, we're just here to make money, and you know, probably the main merchant families and probably the main slave trading families know about them, right? Mm-hmm. And anybody who does a lot of business is going to know about them, but sort of look the other way or whatever. And so, you know, that also can act as kind of the headquarters of a whisper network, right? Like anytime you have a place where there are groups that are oppressed in an area, mm-hmm. You know, you said you're not going like full on traditional like tier campaign, but there still are people yeah. who are basically, you know, indentured servants and slaves mm-hmm. and people that are oppressed and like all of that kind of thing. So there's also going to be an information network that has to be maintained about how to get certain services to certain groups of people, and probably the black market would be tapped into that somehow, because they're going to make a lot of money by making sure that they can get those goods to the appropriate people and stuff like that. So that's kind of one of those things where it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, an opposing faction for the party. It could just be a collateral faction, right? They're neither good nor bad, but they're there and they're neutral. And maybe if sometime the party contacts them, they end up forming some sort of relationship, whether it's a rivalry or just a kind of neutral, we know you exist, but we're not bothering you, you know, mm-hmm. or if they end up owing somebody who has ties to the black market, whatever that society would be, right? Like, that sort of thing is exactly what you would find kind of in the buried city below, right?
Mm-hmm. No, that's and a good idea.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, when you were talking about black market, that really made me think. So one of the characters is a gladiator, and this is sort of before the fall of Kallak. And so I said that Kallak said that nobody can do gladiatorial fights until his big games. So kind of everybody is starved for fights. And that's sort of how the gladiator was making his money before. And so,
right.
Making like a black market, you know, gladiatorial fight, maybe they're going to have it up on top of the city somewhere first, and mm-hmm. then they're going to get raided by Templars, and then they're going to have to go underground. I think that's a great idea.
Right. Right. Yeah. Also, there's probably some kind of training network, right? Where, you know, you don't want to be stuck like having to just fight in the arenas all the time. You need to have some skill, and you can't just have like, oh, you got lucky and you've got big muscles. Like there has to be some kind of way for certain individuals to sort of get out of that life, but they have to get trained up for that. Right. And so you've probably got some sort of society of people who is willing to help those who seek them out and ask. Right. So I'm more thinking of things like it. You can always put some lairs down there and some villains and some bad factions, but there's also has to be like, you know, this is why, like Jeff mentioned Skullport, like the whole reason that can actually exist and not just collapse in on itself is that there are people, there are individuals in there that are actually providing services to those who need it. Mm. And that's also going to have to be present in your underground sort of complex city, whatever you're calling it, right? Mm-hmm. It can't just be lairs and, you know, ancient tombs that you're going to raid and whatnot. It has to also have some sort of an economic cycle down there, because some things exist down there. And yet there also has to remain a reason for them to keep going topside and keep dealing with the upper, you know, mm-hmm. the people who live above ground and whatnot. So yeah, right. I'm always very fascinated by underground cities and how people end up like trying to incorporate what is supposed to be secret with what's not secret. And there's always like a razor edge fine line between how far you can go before the whole thing, all the beans are spilled and everybody kind of knows that thing exists. Right. And so there's kind of this unspoken agreement that we don't talk about this area because we don't want anybody to find out. That doesn't mean the area is perfect or all 100% good, but we don't mention it because we don't want the Templars to come in and raid it. Right.
Right.
So, yeah.
Oh, yeah, great ideas. Thank you.
There's also, as Sam was talking, like you were talking about the black market, gray market idea and all of that. And it made me think of the first layer of Undermountain. Because the first layer of Undermountain has a lot of those things in it too. And then it occurred to me, well, Undermountain could just be reskinned and it is down there, right? Mm-hmm, and then it made me remember another a big campaign adventure with ancient ruins deep under the city and whatever. And it made me think, oh, you could reskin the Bane Warrens, which was a Monty Cook adventure from 3rd edition that they did a 5th edition conversion of.
Haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, so it's Bane Warrens, one word. And it's, you know, it's ancient civilization, or it's ancient, you know, Warrens, vaults, whatever, deep under the city and whatever. And I'm like, oh, that... One of the things that's always intrigued me about Dark Sun, like, it has this, like, oppression and rising above and throwing off your chains sort of theme to it, right?
Right.
But the thing that always gets me is that, like, Dark Sun has this like ancient civilization that just really intrigues me. And I don't know, I know almost nothing about it. Right. And yet
yeah.
there, they were powerful and they were interesting. And the Bane Warrens feel like a kind of adventure you could bring in, or location, it's a big dungeon sort of adventure you could bring in that would very much evoke like, oh no, this isn't just an ancient dungeon. This is a dungeon from the pre-defiling days, before the dragons, the Dragon of Tyr and the Sorcerer Kings and all that kind of stuff, you know?
And nice.
That could be an interesting thing to bring in. At least that would scratch that itch for me in Dark Sun, because that's a thing I've always wanted to explore.
Yeah, definitely. When we did our session zero, that was one of the things that we talked about, is like, they want these mysteries and they kind of want to learn about the past. So okay, that's perfect.
Well, and I don't know how well the Bane Warrens would fit for you.
Sure. But just the idea.
Because I never really read it thoroughly, because I played in a Bane Warrens campaign back in the third edition days. And that was a long enough ago that I have very little recollection of what it was like, other than it was in Tolas. I don't know if you're familiar with Monte Cook's Tolas setting.
Yeah.
Which also means it wasn't exactly like standard D&D. That was sort of his reimagining of D&D with different races and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah.
But I bet it could be reskinned into an interesting thing that could be under the city. So,
yeah, I'll check it out.
Yeah, cool.
So I just want to throw in one more thing. I know his time was over a little while ago, but just to throw in one more thing there for you. It also is sometimes really interesting to throw in something that is not found anywhere else, like in that area, but is of limited resource, right? Like, so like a garden, right? That's growing, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, or some kind of fancy tree that doesn't grow in this area above ground, or some kind of something that somebody or some family or some group of people has learned to cultivate, and it grows really slowly and they can only grow so much of it at a time, but it's like, you know, it's a delicacy, right? Or it's super expensive and you can't get it anywhere else. And, you know, like, just something like that, that would be wondrous. If imagine someone from a completely desert planet finding, you know, an underground forest full of butterflies, right? Or full of like ladybugs, right? Just a very small, like 10 foot by 10 foot area, like 5 trees and 100 butterflies, right? But fascinating enough, like, what the hell is going on here, right? But not necessarily harmful, not also not lucrative, because you can't sustain it and like mass produce it, or, you know what I mean? Like, things like that will really make it like, oh, this is really different from, like, this is part of why people aren't talking about this, because they don't want this found out.
Mm-hmm. Well, and those are the things, like, it has been talked about a lot over the years of D&D, right? When you play a dark and gritty campaign like Ravenloft, or an oppressive campaign like is common in Athas, right? It's important to have notes of contrast, right? It's important in the middle of your Curse of Strahd campaign to have some humor, you know. And so what Sam's talking about would be a nice counterpoint to the oppressiveness of Athas.
Definitely.
Then there's this moment of light, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I like it. Thanks.
Cool. Well, I look forward to 3 months from now when we have you back on and we check in and see how it's going. So,
yeah.
I want to encourage folks, if you are interested in the Tome Show being as awesome as it is and helping me pay the bills, you can support me on patreon.com/thetomeshow and contribute as little as a dollar a month. And that helps keep me going. So, Sam.
Yes.
You get to go next. I'm going to put 15 minutes on the clock and we're going to be on top of it.
We're going to be right on top of it and then right past it.
As we do. Tell us about your game.
All right. So, a couple of things. I recently have done something that it's been a really long time since I have done that thing. And that thing is gaming in person. So I am super stoked because in December I ran a couple of sessions of Castles and Crusades in person. I was playtesting a adventure that I wrote for Greyhawk Fan Magazine that's going to be released probably not till the summertime, but I wrote and play tested the adventure in person with a group of people. It was awesome. Been a really long time since I played in person. I hadn't played in person for 3 years. I'd been playing online. I've been playing online for a decade or more, right? But I hadn't played in person since about 3 years before the pandemic. So it's been almost 6 years since I've played in person.
Even when you played with those kids, that wasn't in person?
Well, so that was, but that wasn't like my weekly ongoing campaign. Right. That was kind of a, we'll get it when we can. And as soon as the pandemic hit, we just went online. Like, so I played, I think, 3 times with them in person, and then the pandemic hit. So you're right. You're right. You're absolutely right. I did play, but that's different because it's not like my friend gaming group. It was, you know, my coworkers' kids, right? And some neighborhood teenagers. So, not to denigrate them, that they were great players and whatnot, but you know what I mean. So I played that. And then I also, I found a local group to play in person with, relatively local to me. That's in a, at a distance that I can actually drive, and it's, you know, it's worth it, so to speak. You know, like at some point, if you drive 2 hours one way, it's not worth it, right? If you drive 2 hours one way to have a 4 hour game and then drive 2 hours back, you just spent your entire day, right? So I found a group that is much less than 2 hours away. So I've played a session with them, and they're a great group. And I think we're going to be good friends, and it's going to be a sustainable group. And we're going to play about every other week. And we're going to do, they're all GMs, right? So the whole group is people who run games. So basically we each get like 6 or 8 sessions, and then we switch to a new GM. They get to pick the game. We're just going to play whatever that person wants to play for 6 or 8 sessions. Then we go to the next person. And so by the time you get back, right? So yeah, so that'll be really fun. For them, I'm running Castles and Crusades because they wanted to play it and they wanted to be introduced to it, and they've never played it before. And so what I'm doing is it's taking place in my homebrew world, but my homebrew world, that area that they're in, is sort of loosely based on the Grand Duchy of Karamikos, which is an old, you know, basic D&D Mystara setting. And the adventure, though, is loosely—I say loosely because I completely change everything all the time, right? But, the seed of the idea, the kernel of the idea, right? The adventure is based on this adventure from 1997 or 1998, something like that. It's a TSR era adventure, it's early second edition, late second edition days, like by Bruce Cordell. It's called The Shattered Circle, and it's a good low level adventure. And it's got lots of Bruce Cordell kind of weird hinky stuff, but also lots of traps and things to explore. And it has some sort of built-in lore that you didn't have to like really build up beforehand for it to make sense, that kind of thing. So that's going really well. So we've played one session, and there was a huge snowstorm and I had to drive home in this giant snowstorm. But anyway, that's beside the point. That's nobody's fault.
So it was last week.
Yes. Yeah, that was, this was very recent. It was last week. But I have also still been running my Traveler game. We did take a break. We took a hiatus in December and the first part of January for my Traveler game. Since I recorded here last, I haven't talked about it, updated everything. So I'll update you on that. And hopefully I'll get done before my 15 minutes is up. But I've already been talking for several minutes, so who knows?
You still have 11 minutes. You're good.
Yeah, awesome. See, that's it. So one of the things that I think when you last heard about my campaign, I think what was happening was they were en route to do a job, and the job was to protect this person who was basically running for Space Pope. I think that's where we left off.
Remember having that conversation?
Yeah. So the name is not really Space Pope, but that's basically what it is for this particular planet. The person becomes the Pope.
Is the name Spope?
No, it's it's the main scribe is basically what they're called, because it's based on the religion of the planet, and it's so it doesn't even really matter. What matters is when one of them is either about to pass away or steps down, there's an election. And the election, it has to do with the most powerful founding families of the planet. And so the party got hired to retrieve an artifact, and they retrieved it and they fought off some people that were coming to take the artifact instead. And that artifact sort of proves the founding, or supports the founding family status of this one particular family. And so, and I talked about that on a previous episode. Yes. And so what happened is that that guy now, who turned out to be like this really immature kind of jerk, but he paid them what he said he was going to pay them. And then he offered them this enormous amount of money to be his bodyguards during the election. And the election, the way it works is they have like this opening ceremony, and then there's like a few hours where some negotiations can occur, so that if certain powerful families want to put their support to others, there can be negotiations. And those negotiations are like recorded so that they know that no illegal dealings are happening, right? And then after the several hours of negotiation period, and it's not forced. They all get to like pick. They put the top two names of the people they want to negotiate with, and then it matches based on upper choices, right? So you basically negotiate with two or three other families trying to get enough people to vote for you. And then they have like this, you know, 3-hour kind of almost debate where you can take the floor and say what you're, you know, why you would be the best, you know, Pope, basically. And then there's a vote. And the thing is, it's not just the families voting. It's the other like 6 billion people who are able to cast a vote, because the planet has 60 billion people on it, but only like 10 billion of those are actually voting members, right? Like the others are not high enough cast to be able to vote. But anyway, so that's what's happening. So the party has agreed to protect this person as a show of force, to wear like these big, and he bought them all kinds of whatever equipment they asked for. He bought them and delivered it to them. And so they've got like all this really fancy combat armor and all this stuff. And then as they're en route about to go down into the atmosphere so they can dock and start the day of the ceremonies where they're going to have this person be elected, the Third Imperium contacts them and says, you need to just go away. Just go away. This is a problem. And so remember, they stumbled across a situation where they saw an entire hidden fleet of the Third Imperium ships on a close by planet in the same system, but like completely masked and hidden. And they accidentally stumbled across it. So they know some stuff is going down, but they're just not sure what. But they kind of figured out, well, this planet has 60 billion people on it. And if you want to recruit people to be a part of your army and indoctrinate them into the Imperial Navy and be able to continue to expand your Imperium, you need a lot of bodies for that. So they kind of figured out the Imperium is probably going to take this point of weakness where this planet is without a leader right now, and they're about to have this election, and it's a really contentious election, and so the Imperium is probably going to do something. They're probably going to intervene and interdict the planet and make it so that it's an issue. So the Imperium contacts them and says, you need to just go away. You need to not be here. Some stuff is going to go down, and we don't want any Imperial citizens part of this. We don't want to have to run a rescue operation. We don't want to have to hear on the news how there's some Imperials that got trapped here. We're like, we don't, just go away. It'll be fine. We'll ignore that you were here. Don't worry. Nobody's going to come after you. It doesn't matter. You can just ignore the job that you agreed to do. Just go. And they basically said, no, we're going to do our job. Like they thought about it. They had a conversation about it in the players, right? And they decided, no, you know, we're going to do it. And so the Imperium comes back and says, okay, well, since you're refusing to leave, now we're going to have a job for you. You have to take this person that we are giving you, and you need to make sure that he gets access to the servers for the Ritz headquarters. The Ritz is the name of the religion. So you need to get him access to the server room in the Ritz so that he can get the information that he needs to get. And you need to do it without saying that he has anything to do with the Third Imperium or that you do. So they're like, oh, crap. So now we're going to be stuck, because if that goes wrong, it's their fault. And if the election goes wrong, it's their fault. And if something happens and they get trapped, it's their fault because they didn't just leave, right? So they're so kind of between...
They could have just left, and now they're embroiled because they
could have just... And before that, some of the other families had contacted... Representatives of the other families had contacted them and said, look, we'll give you X number of dollars to just not show up to this job, to just don't show up and protect this person. He's very bad for the planet. He's not going to be a good leader. He is going to, you know, be the downfall of my civilization. Just go. We'll pay you, you know, 6 million credits to just go away. 10 million credits, just go away. And they refused all of it. So when the Imperium came and told them basically the same thing, just leave, they're like, no, we're not going to just leave. We already had that chance for money. We're not just going to do it because you said so, you know. But they at least knew, okay, well, the third Imperium is doing something, right? So they go in, they get the guy in, they sit there, they protect their patron, their client. And the election doesn't quite go the way that they want. And right at the end of the voting period, so everybody gives their speeches, right at the end of the voting period, some guards come in and tell a couple of the heads of the important families, of the founding families, that there's been a breach in the server room. And everybody needs to go back to their quarters, and everybody's going to kind of be quarantined until they can figure, like, nobody's allowed to leave and all this kind of stuff. So they're like, oh crap, we're going to go to jail. They're like, they're going to put us all in jail. They're going to keep us away from our ship and all this, that, and the other. So it was a pretty dramatic thing, but they didn't have to like have a firefight. They thought, oh crap, there's going to be like explosions and there's going to be a fight and somebody's going to die. And like, it's going to be horrible, but they ended up going and, someone from another one of the founding families came to talk to them and basically tell them, look, your guy's not going to win. And we know that you have something to do with the Imperium. So why don't you just leave? And it's fine. Just don't ever come back here. Like, basically that's what, there was more talking, but that's basically what it was. And they kind of talked about it and decided, yeah, you know, we should just go to get our ship and just go. Like, we should just go. And so that's basically what they, there's a few details I'm skipping, but basically that's what they did. So they left. As they left, they sort of get out into orbit and they see all of these Imperial ships. And then they, as they're about to leap, as they're about to get, they're almost out to jump distance because you have to go outside of the gravity well. Otherwise your jump, you might have a misjump. So they're getting out to jump distance and the news thing comes in. Cause as long as you're within, with, as long as you're not out to jump distance, you can still get the news feed from the Imperium and from all the planets. And the news feed comes in and it basically says, oh, this is a red zone now. Nobody's allowed to come here. Which means the Imperium has completely interdicted it. And they're like, oh crap, it's thank goodness that we actually decided to leave. Because if they hadn't, they would have been stuck on that planet and they might not have had access to their ship. So they made good choices. But as they left, they were leaving to go to, so this, that's like two sessions. The next session, we start it with them jumping away and they're in jump space. They come out of jump space, but they came out of jump space too soon. They were supposed to get all the way to the system called the Union system, where they were going to be able to refuel and whatnot. And they fell out of jump too early, which means there's something there that popped them out of jump because they couldn't stay in jump because there would have been a catastrophic event. And they come out of jump and they look over and they see basically something that looks like a giant wormhole. And they're like, oh crap, what is that? And they're not sure. And then they see the ship sort of limping out of it, but the ship is clearly damaged. So they scan it for life signs and it has like five individuals on it, but it's a big ship. So it probably had more on it before, but they're not sure. Anyway, they get contacted by the ship and the people on the ship are kind of a little bit weird. Like it's almost like Uncanny Valley kind of stuff, right? Like they're communicating, but like they're getting an official communication from a representative of the military, right? Of like the Third Imperium, but the person's not wearing the right uniform and they're not really using the right language. And they've experienced this before when it was somebody and because they were trying to hide something. So they're like, oh crap, like this is a problem for us again. But they end up getting invited to go on the ship because basically the ship said, this is a distress signal. Like, please come help us. We're in trouble. And you could see, scan us. You could see all the damage and whatnot. So they get to this ship and the ship has weird stuff in it. It's got like, it's only got five people on it, but they all act very strange and they say very strange things. And long story short, because I heard my timer just go off, they eventually figure out that there's some weird energy source on this ship that is influencing everything. And they get to a point where they can communicate with whatever this entity is, because it turns out it's psionic, so it can actually talk to you in your head, right? So it's speaking to them. Basically, it tells them, look, I need you and you need me. I will give you enough fuel to get out of here, and I will leave your ship unharmed and unscathed, and I will give you the fuel. But I hunger. I need something too. I need fuel too. And that fuel is living life forms. And what I didn't remind you of before, which I think I talked about on one of the previous episodes, is they also recovered the artifact for the founding family guy. They also found an older human in a cryo birth who looked like he had some kind of disease or something. And they woke him up and he was alive. There were a bunch of other ones, but they weren't alive. So he was alive. So they took him on board their ship, and he's got some kind of weird metabolic disorder. He like has all these growths on him, and he eats all the time. He's really, really hungry all the time. And he has this uniform with this really old symbol on it, and they don't know what it is. It turns out he's kind of like they don't know what's wrong with him, but he can't communicate with them. He's like, there's something wrong. Right. And so basically they're trying to decide, well, do we give this guy to the thing and then it'll give us the fuel and we can get away, or what are we going to do? Or are we going to try to fight? Because, you know, we don't want to give up, even though we don't really know who this guy even is, we don't want to just give them, you know, plus they also had a passenger on their ship who was paying them for a job. Who is a clandestine, like, Soleimani security guy who they don't know. He's like a double agent spy guy, but they know he's a passenger. And so they're trying to not tell him things, but tell him enough that he knows they're in danger. Like, so there's all this stuff going on. And long story short, they decide to fight it, and it almost kicks their butt, but it gates away at the end, and they have to spend like a day and a half repairing their ship, and then trying to figure out how the heck to get to the next civilized system. And so that's kind of where that's leaving off. But so, it's a lot of fun.
So both of you are running campaigns with mind flayers in it. I mean, clearly, obviously not, right? But
I didn't
want other people as food. Yeah.
I didn't think of it like that, but yeah, it's kind of like a mind flayer. I mean, there's mm-hmm. a sort of a different backstory going on there. Mm-hmm. Because they got into its computer banks and they could read like where it's been, like how far it can move in one jump, and like mm-hmm. they got like some data. And they're like, oh, this came from Soleimani space and it's from over here. But weird, that means it jumped like 12 parsecs and we can't really do that. We don't have technology to do that. So there's weird stuff going on. But that's kind of it's a sideline thing. Like right. It's not really part of their main thing. But yeah, you're right. Probably I could have like pictured it as a big giant mind flayer. That would have given it away really quick though, right? They would have automatically known.
Or you could have pulled a Stranger Things and it'd be something that doesn't look anything like a mind flayer, but just call it one.
Right. Yeah. Yes, true. Yep.
Yeah. Right on. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, it is. I think everybody's enjoying it, which is the point, right? It's fun for me, of course, but my players are giving me good feedback too. So
good. So before we move on to my time, I want to remind people that if you want to chat with some of us that are in Tome Show world, we have various social medias. We are still on Twitter. We are also, although fewer and fewer of us are active on Twitter, we have a Facebook group that mostly you'll get updates, but occasionally a few people leave some comments there and we have some conversations. But mostly you want to come hang out on the Tome Show Discord because that's where all the good conversations that's where the best conversations are usually happening. It's a nice group where there's enough people in the Tome Show Discord that we're always having interesting conversations, but not so many that I feel like if I'm logged off for a few hours, then I'm lost and I can't participate, right? Because we've all been in both types of Discord groups before. So
yeah.
So and also you can always email thetomeshow@gmail.com. And for example, if you wanted the link to the Discord, I can send it to you that way. Now it is my turn. So I was looking back at my notes and I'm like, wow. I think a lot has happened in my campaign since we last talked. Because when we last recorded, my notes involved that I had basically finished. I injected part of the Adventurers League campaign for Descent into tied to Descent into Avernus into my Descent into Avernus campaign, and so they had just sort of concluded, you know, freeing a bunch of Hellrider souls in the ruins of the Screaming Canyon, and the Chosen of Ilmater is there with them, a little like 8-year-old girl who happened to have read the Book of Exalted Deeds and became a Chosen, you know, and so they've got these allies there. And then they went, and so that's sort of where we left off in our conversation. And there was a big fight with some between a demon and an ice devil, the demon of which I stole from Flea Mortals, you know, a James Intercasso MCDM product. and that was all a lot of fun. Then we kind of got back on the normal Descent into Avernus rails, if you will. I mean, not really rails, but you get the idea, right? We got back on track. And they went and freed the demon lord Costachi, which is part of the idea behind the campaign. I introduced it as sort of Olanthius will tell them where the sword is, but first you have to free Costachi so that Zeriel will be distracted and won't see where the sword is in case you fail. And so they did that. They found out where the sword was. They have to go through the. I'm using ideas from Eventyr's products on punching things up a little bit for Avernus, and I made the Arches of Olloch, instead of just being a way to teleport around in Avernus, it was that's how you teleport yourself to where the Bleeding Citadel is and where the sword is, and so and in doing so, you have to go through a series of challenges. Posed by a great fiendishly corrupted sphinx that guards the arches, whose name is Olloch, thus explaining where the name comes from and whatever. And so they completed that challenge. They got to the Bleeding Citadel. They fought their way through the dungeon that is the scab, that's kind of gross because there's like pools of blood and it's a literal like giant building size scab that you're tunneling through. They fought off the demons that were tunneling through there. They learned about Krokotoek, the giant pet of Yanogu, the gnoll demon lord that was trapped inside the scab when it rose up around the Bleeding Citadel. Big enough that another James Intercasso product, he built a dungeon inside of Krokotoek so that you could run through. My players didn't seem to have a lot of interest in chasing after Krokotoek, so I didn't use it, but and they got to the doors and they opened the Bleeding Citadel, and I played up so the Bleeding Citadel, you know, you get to the sword there, and the story is somebody reaches out, touches the sword, and then everybody's trapped into like a memory of Lulu's, where they see the beginning of the fall of Zeriel, where she dedicated herself to wiping out the demons for the first time after Yanogu sort of destroyed this idyllic village of Idelglin. And so you get to build a little sympathy for who is arguably the arch villain of the story. But because it has this whole memory thing, there's in the book, you like Lulu or somebody touches the doors to the Citadel, and if you're lawful good, they open and there's a blinding light and it does X amount of damage and it destroys, it does X amount of damage to whatever demons are around, and you get the benefits of a long rest, even though you didn't take a long rest and whatever. And I decided to play up since the Bleeding Citadel is all about sort of memories, and you're going to go into this memory of Lulu's and whatever. I use that as an opportunity to give each of my players like a flashback memory that wasn't even necessarily like a real memory. It was like a memory of an ancestor that they all experienced that allowed me to sort of build some things to the into the story. Cause it occurred to me, like when we first went into the scab, I'm like, okay, so we've probably got like 5 or 6 sessions left. And then they flew through the entirety of the scab in one session. And I'm like, oh, this whole thing could be over in 2 sessions. Like if they keep moving at this pace, we're going to be done real soon. And so I wanted to sort of ramp up the, like, some of them have been slow on their sort of exploration of the idea of redemption. And it's, you know, the campaigns, that's sort of the theme is redemption. And I introduced that as the theme originally. And so I use that as an opportunity to sort of tweak some of the, or push some of the stories in certain ways through those memories. And it had some pretty good, pretty strong effect with some of them.
Were the memories all correct? Because I know the elephant Lulu was like, actually couldn't remember certain things. So like, did you make it so that there's anything incorrect about the memories?
So here's the thing. First of all, they weren't Lulu's memories. They were getting memories of like ancestors.
Got you. Sorry, I misheard yeah, yeah. that. I thought they were Lulu remembering.
No, Lulu.
All so the past.
It's Lulu's memory that when they claim the sword, they go into Lulu's memory of Zariel's fall.
Got it.
The beginning of Zariel's fall. Yeah. But I wanted to tie it into them. So, like, for example, I have a character who's who's a paladin who like rejected all the gods that he had sort of looked at when he was training and learning to become a paladin and whatever. He went to all the gods and none of them were a very good fit, but he's slowly sort of been moving in a direction of accepting Bahamut as a potential patron. Bahamut, anytime there's been communication with agents of Bahamut, Bahamut's message has been very clear. Like, I don't need worshipers. I see my followers as allies in this great cosmic, you know, struggle for justice and righteousness and whatever. And that appeals to him a lot. And so he's got that kind of thing going on. So, but he's got this connection. He's from El Terrell. He's got this connection to the Hell Riders. His parents were Hell Riders, et cetera. And so the memory he saw was a memory of his grandmother, or maybe great grandmother, who was a Hell Rider who rode with Zariel. And so I described this vision of your grandmother as a young woman and surprisingly wearing a holy symbol of Bahamut. There might be some family connection here. And then she goes through hell with Zariel, or with the forces of the Hell Riders that came with Zariel, and saw such horrific things that at one point she actually threw down her holy symbol and gave up on her faith, because everything that she had seen was so horrible and so horrific. How could a goodly God allow this kind of thing to happen? And sort of gave up on her faith. And then as she was fleeing with her contingent back through the portal to go back home, she was there as Zariel was being bombarded and attacked, and Bell showed up and instinctively was going to run to Zariel's rescue for a moment and reach down for her holy symbol and realize it wasn't there. And she'd given up on her faith. And then turned around and walked through the portal. And that's when that's when I diverge from the memory, and each of the person they're having the memory with then stops and looks at the person having the vision in the eye and says something to them, you know, and then walks through. And so it creates this interesting and powerful moment that connects into their history, and they all sort of put them on a certain path. And you know, the assassin characters who have always been like, I don't regret anything. Well, it's hard to do a redemption story if you tell me you don't even regret anything, right? Ever. Like, I'm firm in my book. So I use that as a chance to show them, okay, but you're Shatter Kai. You reincarnate. And so I'm going to show you a memory of a past life. And in this past life, you did something that you did regret. And so it's okay to, you know, it's okay to regret. It's okay to doubt. And that's how we grow. And that, you know, so I use it as an opportunity to sort of inject some of those ideas. And that was a lot of fun, and it worked really well. They got through the Bleeding Citadel. They got through Idle-Glin. One of the characters died in the memory. And as the adventure is written, if you die in the memory, you die. Except at the end, because you're fighting Yonogu, and Yonogu's way too powerful for them. And so Yonogu's wiping the floor with them. And so the character dies, and then Zariel shows up and saves the day and kicks Yonogu through it. Well, Zariel opens up a portal behind Yonogu, and Lulu in giant mammoth form shows up and slams into Yonogu with her tusks and throws Yonogu through the portal.
Right. Poor Yonogu. That's my guy.
Right?
I love me some Knowles and Yonogu. They're right. Awesome.
But then of course now Zariel's there, and so the dead character is resurrected, because Zariel can cast resurrect like three times, and starts bringing people back to life, and then, you know, vows to go on and whatever. But if you die in the memory, you are not worthy to claim the sword. One of the other players was gone that day. He's not worthy to claim the sword because he didn't go through the memory. So there's only two people worthy to claim the sword. And I figured it was probably going to be the already lawful good cleric, Dragonborn cleric, that was going to claim the sword. But I thought to myself, boy, it'd be real interesting if the Shatterkai assassin, like the true neutral, almost, you know, assassin character, claimed the sword and suddenly found themselves as an angelic lawful good character. You know, that would have really been interesting. And it may have ruined the game for that player. I don't know. But if she'd have rolled with it, it could have been a really interesting twist to the whole story. But that's not what happened. And then they figured they've got one more thing they need to do. The assassins have had a contract for, I don't know, 5 or 6 levels now to kill Archon, the Dragonborn champion of Tiamat, who's got the Hand of Vecna and all this other stuff. What they don't know, well, they know that this contract has come from sort of their patron that they've been dealing with since level one, who they know of as the Betrayed, and who they just now learned is actually trapped inside of the second sun companion over Elturel. I replaced the angel that was supposed to be trapped there with this Betrayed patron who's been talking to them and building a network and supporting them this whole time. And they've started to figure out that the Betrayed is actually Kaz the Betrayer, who originally cut out the eye and cut off the hand of Vecna. And one of them is carrying the sword of Kaz I've been using like the critical role vestiges of divergence idea. So it sort of levels up over time. I didn't hand him an artifact at level one. I sort of leveled it up slowly over time. And the last thing necessary to level it up would be to kill somebody who's carrying a part of Vecna. So they needed to go after Archon. Archon is also the great great uncle of the Dragonborn cleric, who's now just turned into an angel and has been corrupting his brother towards Tiamat this whole time as well. So they got a reason to go after Archon. Problem is, they had signed an infernal contract with Archon and Bell a while ago, and so they're like, well, we can't just go after Archon. Like, we need to go after Archon, but we can't do it for like a year when this contract runs up. So that's not going to be any good. But I gave them an out, because the whole idea of when you claim the sword of Zeriel is it sort of overwrites who you are. You are no longer the person you were when you claim the sword of Zeriel. There's all these warnings ahead of time. Like, make sure when you claim the sword that you know what you're getting into, because they almost talk about it like you will die and become somebody new, right? And I figured, there's an out. That new person never signed the contract, right? This is the whole new person. They don't count as the same person. Their soul has been changed, and so there's an out. As long as this person attacks first and Archon responds, then the contract is null and void, right? And they did. And they fought off Archon, as well as the brother, as well as Archon's entire entourage. And it was a big fight, and it was a tough fight. That happened 2 weeks ago. I had minis. I 3D printed minis for all of the different various things. And I had one of my players who's big into painting, paint all the minis. And it was a big fight, and it was a hard fight. And ultimately they won. The Dragonborn managed to find a way to not kill his brother and to spare his brother, because I've described this sort of generational cycle of violence that their family keeps getting caught up in, and now they've got a chance to break that cycle. And then it was like, okay, well, meanwhile, the reason you were coming after your brother is because he stole your fiance and child. And you learned a while ago that your fiance and child have been trapped inside of a gym by Bell because of the work that your brother had done. How are you going to get him out? So I figured after they dealt with Archon, it would be, we got to go to Bell and figure out how to open this gym and get the family out. But they made a decision that we're going to kind of handle that, like that Zeriel is the higher priority. We're going to go deal with the Zeriel thing, and then we can kind of do that in epilogue after the campaign has ended. Which means the next session that we have, which was supposed to be last weekend, but then snow happened and we decided not to meet. And now it's supposed to be tomorrow. And we're getting another possible 8 inches of snow tomorrow. So it may not happen as well. We'll see what happens. I told him on our group Discord today that apparently Oral is mad at us and has cursed our campaign, trying to end this campaign.
There wasn't enough Yithrin in your campaign. Right,
because we didn't decide to run Rhyme of the Frostmaiden for our next campaign. So Oral's mad at us. But in any case, the next session, which could be tomorrow, which could be next week, in theory, will be the end of the Descent into Avernus campaign that we've been playing now for, I think we're up to 75 sessions, so at least a good couple of years, probably. And I've got ideas for what to do with epilogue stuff. I had this. Sometimes as a DM, you just throw chaos at the wall without a clear sense of how you're going to clean it up, because it creates interesting situations. And I don't know how this plays out, but one of the storylines that's been run through the campaign is the Shield of the Hidden Lord that you have the chance to find in Baldur's Gate in like level 3. And inside of the Shield of the Hidden Lord is the devil Gargoth, who in Forgotten Realms lore used to be a god, was worshipped as a lesser god or a demigod, depending on which edition. And I actually had them trap Gargoth in the shield in the prior campaign. So they got some, as players, they've got some history with Gargoth. And then they get to this campaign and the mission is free Gargoth from the shield. The previous characters put him in, right? And they did, because the sword is powerful enough that it could break the shield and free Gargoth. And they did, and he's free. And he said, oh, by the way, I'm going to help you out with your whole Zariel situation. When it all comes down, I will be there. I will bring my allies and my forces, and we will keep the other devils and demons, help keep those all busy so you can deal with the Zariel situation. But you got to help me out. When it comes down to it, when there's a power vacuum and nobody's here ruling Avernus anymore, I want your endorsement for Archduke of Avernus. And that was the scheme that I had planned in my head for him for a while. And then it occurred to me just in the last week or two. Why does Gargoth want to be the Archduke of Avernus? He used to be a god. Archduke of Avernus feels like a demotion, right? For sure. And then It occurred to me, I think he wants the job, and then he's not going to do the job. And there won't be an Archduke of Avernus. And the demons will overrun the first layer of hell and move on into Dis and start attacking Dispater. And it's going to throw all of the hells into chaos. And in doing that, there will be some opportunity for him to seek divinity again, right? When Asmodeus isn't paying attention because he's dealing with all these other things. Because it takes a lot to get past Asmodeus, who's like a master manipulator, right? So I don't know how that resolves, but I decided that's definitely going to be part of the epilogue. Like, you did all this stuff and Gargoth became the new Archduke of Avernus, just like you planned, except he didn't do the job. And over the next few years, all this is going down and now the demons are overrunning. And what's going to be the result of that in future campaigns? Who knows? But I look forward to finding out, you know?
Yeah.
I also was thinking about some things and realized there is a potential meta villain to all of my campaigns, and maybe 5, 10, 20 campaigns down the road, you know, whoever knows how many decades this group will be playing together, hopefully, there could be this other villain that is actually manipulating and creating all of these things or setting all these things up to win. And I think at the end of the day, Vecna's kind of running everything. Vecna was responsible in the first campaign for the release of the dark powers from Ravenloft. I think Vecna is setting things up so that Gargoth can throw the hells into chaos. I think in our next campaign, which will be Wild Beyond the Witchlight, I'm going to start introducing like incursions from the Far Realm, which feels very much like a thing that Vecna could be doing. Why? What's his plan? I don't know. When it comes to figures like Vecna or Asmodeus, I kind of see it as, no, I'm just going to do shit. And then I'll figure out later why it was their plan all along, because I'm not as smart as Vecna. I'm not as manipulating as Asmodeus, right? So as a DM, I'm just going to, whatever they do, whatever happens, that was the big bad guy's plan all along. And I'll figure out why later, you know? So that could be fun if I end up playing more with that and dealing with that. Hopefully none of my players have listened to any of that.
Too late.
That would be big spoilers for both what I'm going to do with the next campaign and 20 campaigns down the line. But so
anyway. you're doing Wild Beyond the Witchlight next.
So that's going to be the next campaign. So a few sessions ago, and I realized we were going to be done soon, I handed them two menus and I said, okay, what do you want to do for the next big campaign? And they chose Wild Beyond the Witchlight, and it was actually a close one. There was a chance they were going to do, I think it's Chains of Asmodeus that was put out recently, that would be a continuation with the same characters as Descent into Avernus. And they're like, well, maybe we want to do this one, because if we don't do it now, we're not going to come back to it later. And so it was real close, but we play tested Witchlight, and it was some of the most fun D&D any of us had ever played. So we ended up going, we decided to go do Witchlight. But the other menu was, and here's a bunch of other games. Could we do like one or two shots of a bunch of other things just for a couple of months as a palate cleanser? I have a hard time going from one big campaign. We finished it. Now let's jump right into the next one, right?
So right.
I like to use these other games as a palate cleanser. And so we're going to do a little bit of Blades of the Dark, a little bit of Fiasco, a little bit of... I got a used copy of Star Wars Saga Edition, so I think we'll play a little bit with that.
Nice.
I backed the Cthulhu Awakens Kickstarter from Green Ronin. Mm-hmm. It's Green Ronin's age system version of Cthulhu stuff. There were some other things. But we've got a handful of other games that we're going to try to kind of play around with for a few months. So you'll get to hear about all those as we go through them. I don't know which one we're going to do first. It might be Torg, because I'm always ready to run more Torg. We were going to do one of the one shots for Torg, but.
Now, Robert, are you still running three games?
I think I'm running four now.
Four now.
So, So I've got I got the one Dark Sun game, and that's weekly, the one we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And then I have a every 2 weeks high level game, their 14th level, which is the same level as the Planescape game. They are about to they know about Drigoth, who's like a lich, basically a Dark Sun lich. Mm-hmm. And now they're going to like run into him finally and stop him from becoming a god. And then I've got the every other week Ashes of Athas game, which is an organized play for 4th edition. Mm-hmm. But I've converted it all to 5th edition. So they are halfway done with that. They're like 5th level out of 7 or 8, I think. Yeah.
Fun.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very cool.
All right. Well, I have other questions to ask, but we are well past an hour of recording at this point, so I might just ask the two of you something. It's not necessarily DMing related, I'm curious to get some ideas on some stuff from y'all. Mm-hmm. But I'll just ask you off camera and or off recording, and we can.
Every fan we have is cussing right now.
Okay, fine. So
they're going to be like, Jeff, we wanted to hear the questions and answers.
Maybe they will, maybe they won't, because I don't know how.
Well, they can just turn off the recording if they don't want to hear it.
Fine. So I have been for the last year or so the faculty co-lead for a new makerspace on our campus. Mm-hmm. And part of what I'm supposed to do as a faculty co-lead is run events. And myself, the other co-lead, and sort of the director of the space were talking recently, and we decided that finally we're going to do the event that I've been talking about for a year. We're going to do a D&D night in the makerspace. And we've got all, because one of the groups that has been most, in for personal use, most getting the most use out of the makerspace is one of the D&D groups on campus who comes in and prints their miniatures and cuts dice boxes on the laser. And you know, they're doing all kinds of fun stuff like that. And so we're like, there's clearly a demand. There's an interest here. Mm-hmm. Let's do a D&D night. So my question was going to be, or is going to be, I've got some ideas, but what do you think we should do as part of the event? Like, what kind of activities should there be in a makerspace with a laser, with a vinyl cutter, with a button maker, with five 3D printers, a little lobby space with tables? If you were gonna run an event, a D&D event in a makerspace with that kind of, those kinds of tools available, and somewhere between 4 and 7 hours to do stuff, what kind of activities would you have available for people to do? What would you enjoy doing?
I think it would be cool to kind of like, let's I don't really know, how long does it take to say print a miniature?
A few hours.
A few hours, so
probably,
like,
at least.
So maybe beforehand, like, you give people like a list of different miniatures and like whatever other little things they could make, and then whatever they choose, you take all that and like make an adventure out of it.
Okay. So people, for that, people would have to RSVP, but you RSVP, you tell me what kind of character you want. I build it in Hero Forge or whatever, and we 3D print them and have them ready to go. Mm-hmm. And then we can run an adventure with those characters.
Yeah. Okay.
Does the game group or whatever the ones who are using the for personal use, do they have like a name of their group, or do they have like a logo, or is there something you could produce either in wood or with a 3D printer, like, that would like highlight their logo or something? Like, I don't.
Yeah, definitely. And that's one of the things we talked about. Like, I found like little dice boxes, where you you use what, 1/8 inch plywood, and you cut out 6 layers and glue them together, and you can edit and make it how you want. The part of the thing is that group has informed us, or has been our sign that there is an interest, but I know for a fact that they are not the only D&D group on campus.
Right.
So this would be for a larger group, not just them. Mm.
Right. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, if it's easy to do that sort of thing, then you could do that for, you could make some of those for the group that you know has an interest, and be like, you know, this is the type of thing we can do. Like, the whole point is to show off the types of things you can do. So if I was going to go to an event like that, and I didn't know anything about, you know, wood cutting or engraving or any kind of 3D printing, I would want to understand the process a little bit more. So, like, I would want to sit through not an hours long thing, but just like, okay, from start to finish, if I wanted to create a mini, what do I do? Or if I wanted to create little medallions for my gaming group, what would I do? Like, how do I go about that? How easy is it? And let's make one that you could see being made, right? And that's why I mentioned like the other group, because then you could already have that one sort of keyed up.
Yeah,
so that they could see the end product. And then if somebody wanted, you know, because then it's talking about what can this facility do, right? And that's really what the fair is for. But you want to show it off a little bit, right? You don't just want to give, it's not like a boring seminar. Okay, and then you press this button, and then you design.
We want to show it off, but we also want to have fun and play games and. You know, there are 3 game stores within a couple miles of our campus, right? We could partner with one or all of those game stores and have them come out and run demos, or have one of them bring somebody out to like, hey, we 3D printed miniatures for you. Now they're going to run you through like a painting workshop and show you how to paint those.
Right.
There you go.
Fun stuff like that. So, but I thought maybe. No, I just wanted to get other ideas.
You could also do like a little tournament scenario, like not a huge giant, like 4-hour game, but just like, so, you know, do it like old Gen Con, right? Okay, we're going to play for an hour, and whichever PC gets the most points, right, of whatever, like, you know, then you get your own mini. We'll print you whatever that you want to have created, right? Like, so, like some kind of an award thing there. And also maybe a raffle. If you were going to do a raffle, like, you could raffle off some, you know, I mean, I don't know what the rules are around the facility in the first place. So obviously if that one D&D group is coming in and using it for personal use, it's not like super restricted, right? So,
yeah, no, the rules of our makerspace, because we're currently, at least currently, because our budget is grant funded. So if you are in for, if you are using this space for personal prototyping or educational use, there is no charge. So if they, when they come in and print their minis, it, it costs them nothing.
Right. Nice. That's awesome in itself. But
which has been fun for me too. I probably use the 3D printer as much as they do, and I'm printing. But you know, I talked about my Yonogu fight. Well, guess who had a custom Yonogu mini that, that he had 3 days earlier. You know.
Right. Right.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Very good. Cool. So that's the kind of thing I do, something interactive, right? Like a, something where they're playing, but just a very short scenario, but they're doing something with it. Something where you send them through the process and they could see that the end product, right? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Excellent. Thank you. So I think we'll go ahead and wrap the episode there. We added an extra, 8 minutes in that conversation. But we'll go ahead and wrap the episode up there. We are have been 3DMs. You can find The Tome Show on the various social medias I mentioned earlier. You can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com. I don't know what else I usually say. So say goodnight, guys.
Night.